Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
In Chico, there is a center for Zen practice called The Still Point, and its founder is best-selling author William Martin. Bill is author of four books, including The Parents' Tao Te Ching and A Path and a Practice, and now he's just written his fifth book, The Tao of Forgiveness. Bill Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, you have a really hot topic now when you talk about Zen, because anytime I pick up a newspaper, I don't care what section I turn to. If it's a sports section, they're talking about a book called Zen Golf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or Tiger Woods going back to his Buddhist roots.
Okay.
Or I look, the fashion section, Donna Karan has a collection called Urban Zen.
Oh, yeah.
And anywhere you look, you can come across these references to it. But I wonder, do we really understand what we're talking about so much?
Well, I certainly don't. it's obviously an overused phrase. Both words, Tao and Zen, are attached to everything under the sun.
And, you know, another place I found, it was an article about Apple, and here's this computer company, and they talk about the techno-Zen aspects of this new product is going to please everybody. So techno-Zen.
No, I hadn't heard techno-Zen before. Yeah. That one really frightens me because personal reasons. But I can only go back to our own understanding of both the word Tao and Zen as we practice it here at the Still Point. Our center is called Still Point, a center for Zen practice. But as we describe ourselves, we're a center for the practice of conscious, compassionate awareness in the Taoist Zen tradition.
Now, you put both of those words.
We put both of those words together because Zen is a Japanese word that literally means meditation, sitting in meditation. And it comes from the Chinese word Chan, which also means meditation. And its roots, although it's influenced by Buddhism, its roots are deeply Taoist. Taoism, T-A-O, Taoism is both a religion and a philosophy, 3,000-4,000 years old in China. We're in the strain of the philosophical Taoist thought, it's not a religion, but a philosophy expressed by Lao Tzu, the author of the Tao Te Ching 2,500 years ago. And when Buddhism came over into China in the first millennia, it met the already established philosophical Taoism, and the two blended together to become what was called Chan. And then when that went to Japan, it was called Zen. It's essentially Taoism with a little bit of Buddhism thrown in. Now, today, it has all sorts of implications. There are very, very Buddhist Zen groups. There are groups like ours, which are very much more Taoist Zen. We emphasize the Taoist roots because it's much more accessible. It makes us less like a religion and more like a practice of compassionate awareness, of living life with direct experience and intensity and playfulness and joy. And it's that Taoist root that gives what our practice of Zen a sense of realistic, sensual delight in life. You can notice the difference in lots of Buddhist traditions. The statues of Buddha from the lots of Southeast Asian and Indian traditions are very thin and erect and fairly imposing. If there's a smile, it's just kind of a little hint of an enigmatic smile. In the Taoist Zen tradition, Buddhas are fat and sitting kind of squat, and it's not a smile, it's just a full belly laugh. And that's that Taoist root of this is life. This isn't some sort of mind game escape from life. This is just life lived in an ordinary, intense, direct way.
My guest is Taoist scholar and Zen teacher Bill Martin, and we're talking about his newest book, The Tao of Forgiveness, but we really haven't talked about that book yet because we have to understand some of this terminology before we can even talk about the Tao of forgiveness.
Okay.
So you've been helping us to understand this notion of Zen. And when Tiger Woods says he wants to get back to his Buddhist roots, I would imagine it's not this. I don't know. Maybe it is.
I have no idea.
But
I can't speak for more traditional Buddhist expressions. In our center, we have three little statues. One is of Buddha, and he's facing the wall. Mm-hmm. And this is our expression that he is there as our example and teacher of the inner journey, of the root practice of meditation and examining the way our conditioned mind works. Then we have a little statue of Lao Tzu, and he's facing outward, and that's to connect us with the sensual pleasure of life. And a third statue of the Chinese goddess Kuan Yin, who's a representation of the essential compassionate nature. And so in our practice, those three statues go together, the inner journey, the outer connection with life, and conscious, compassionate awareness that bind the two together and allow us to live a life of kindness and gentleness.
You use the word accessible, and I wonder if people really understand and appreciate accessible, because they may somewhat take it for granted. I want to compare when I started reading literature from India, it would just went right over my head because I had to have a really foundation before I could pick up any of that and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the first time I picked up the Tao Te Ching, I understood it right away. I didn't have to study and understand mythical characters or personalities or gods or hierarchies. I could just open that book and understand it.
Yeah.
And it related to my life at that moment.
Me too. When I first picked it up, it was just a wonderful experience. Wow.
And so that's what it means to me when you say this is accessible.
That's what it means to me. At least that's what I hope it is to people. I mean, most of the people I know who've picked up the Tao Te Ching in any translation have a sense of, yeah, there's something here that I just really resonate with.
And it's nothing that is unusual or foreign to our own thinking. It's because it is so true to our own experience.
I think it's true to our own essential nature. It's a little bit foreign sometimes to our conditioned ways of thinking.
Yeah. Well, when you were saying that you don't know what people's experience, you know what you're writing, but you don't always know what the experience will be of the person who reads what you're writing. I not long ago heard a lawyer say when he's talking to the jury, he knows what he has said, but he doesn't know what they have heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think, though, that's a rather exciting element for you as a writer to know that you can put forth this wisdom and people who read it can understand it where they are at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point when you wrote the sentence in your book that experiences in life, and you said events in life, repeat themselves, and it instantly called to mind an expression by our Spanish writer, Azorín, who said, vivir es ver volver. To live is to see return. As you live, you see these cycles of life that repeat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that a point you make in your book, that it's not linear.
No, it's not. It's a very complex experience, isn't it? And things that you thought you learned, here they come again. Things that have disappeared are back again. Old feelings are back. Old connections are back, old memories. Here I am again. Here I am doing this again. Why am I doing this again?
Well, in your book, you suggest that a reader picks up The Tao of Forgiveness, which is your newest book. This is your fifth book. When they open a copy of The Tao of Forgiveness, you recommend that they have a companion book along with them. And that's kind of what I've been wanting to do right now, is to give listeners an idea of what this notion is, the background for why they would want to pick up and read a copy of The Tao of Forgiveness. So what other book do you suggest that they have handy?
I suggested that they have a companion book. Okay. See, I haven't seen a copy of this book
it is
since
so
it's
new.
Been out. Well, I would suggest a copy of The Tao Te Ching, which is the kind of the essential expression of Taoist thought. There are lots of good copies available. I happen to have a version available, and that's in my book, A Path and a Practice. That's what I'd recommend. I'd recommend a copy of the Tao Te Ching and a copy of the Tao of Forgiveness, because my explorations in forgiveness are deeply rooted in the philosophy of the Tao Te Ching.
Well, this book had an interesting origin, I think, as it the idea of other books had their own way of kind of presenting themselves to you, and you thought, oh, this is a good idea for a book.
Uh-huh.
But this book, actually, you had input from people all over the world, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Well, actually, I was approached by the publisher to write a book on the Tao of Forgiveness. That wasn't kind of my idea.
Well, because you've had a lot of successful books
mm-hmm.
based on the Tao Te Ching. And so if I were a publisher, I'd say, hey, Bill, what about another book?
So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then I went, I began an email class. I have students around the country and around the world that I kind of keep in touch with. And we explored the whole idea of forgiveness for about 3 months together. And that exploration was extremely helpful to me. I'm very grateful to those. Now, we're about 35 students around the world that really delved into their problems with forgiveness and their understanding of forgiveness, and we wrote back and forth and explored it. It helped me put the stories together that
yeah, because your book has stories that come from classical literature and then your own experiences. But you know what I really enjoyed was your introduction, particularly since we are probably in the same decade of life. And you mentioned that how the Tao Te Ching, as you went through your 20s and your 30s, you were a different person as mm-hmm. you became older and your 50s. And you said, well, this, as far as this last, I'll let you know how this one turns out.
Yeah.
But you also say that that the advice that writers are always given is write what you know.
Yes.
And this is the first myth that you explode in your book.
Well, I hope I explode lots of myths. That's kind of what my life is about, exploding my own myths. That's another good definition of Zen. Explode your own myths and come to a direct experience. But I'll just read this paragraph.
Yeah, do that.
Because it was, some experts on the craft of writing advise write what you know. I've spent my career writing about all the things I don't know. I wrote a book on parenting when the only thing I knew was every possible mistake a parent can make. I wrote about love between two people, a mystery that no one could possibly really know anything about. And I wrote about growing old with grace and courage, and I'll let you know how that turns out. And then here in my early 60s, I'm given the opportunity to look at Lao Tzu again from the idea of forgiveness, and I don't know what I'm talking about. I'll figure it out as I go along. It's interesting. You say, I write this wisdom and a reader reads it and hears it from their own perspective. When I read it, I hear it from my own perspective. Whenever I'm uncomfortable with the term wisdom literature, but that's in a sense what I write. And I tend to write what I don't know. And I read it a few years later and sense that there actually is some wisdom there, but it's wisdom that escaped me at the time. I write about what I would like to experience in my life, but usually about 5 years ahead of actually experiencing it.
Well, you probably heard the expression that we teach what we want to learn.
That's exactly right.
And your writing is a way of exploring and figuring this out for yourself.
It is. It's a way of exploring for me.
You know, you tell a story in the book, and you say that you're riding along, and this bicyclist commits error that is his fault, and you stew about that.
Did I write that? Is that in there? Is that in the book?
Because none of us would do such a thing.
I think I vaguely remember that. I think I vaguely remember we got in a shouting match with each other and said some very un-Taoist things to each other and eventually calmed down and you know, we were both very grateful that no one was hurt. And I stewed about it for a while and then I saw that whole process of my conditioned mind telling me how I shouldn't have yelled, or 15 seconds later telling me that I should have beat the crap out of him, or all these stories about who I should and shouldn't be. And all the while waiting for me was my Tao mind that just said, Well, of course you yelled. You were frightened. He was frightened. Aren't we glad that nothing happened? I would suggest that you look at the flowers and taste your coffee and take a nice deep breath and realize just how grateful you are to be alive in this moment right now. Those are the two contrasting pieces of nurture that we get. One is conditioned. One is deeply, deeply accepting of all of life.
And to pull out labels like, well, I was right and he was wrong.
Well, I was.
But in the long run, don't serve us.
Or don't even look
for right answers. There's got to be a right answer to this.
Because we're so afraid. We're so afraid of our own essential tenderness. And we're so afraid of the essential transient nature of life that we all understand is there underneath our bravado, that we, by the use of labels and categories, we create a facade of understanding. If I can understand that he's wrong and I'm right, then I can get a handle on this whole thing and life gets pushed back into its nice compartments that it's safe and predictable once again. Of course, until the next unpredictable thing happens. And the Tao mind would say that, you know, life is not safe. You're not going to get out of it alive. It's totally unpredictable. And that's just fine. Let's throw up our arms. Let's enjoy the ride because I'm here. You're always a part of everything that's happening. There's nothing to be afraid of.
My guest is Taoist scholar and Zen teacher Bill Martin, and we're talking about his newest book, The Tao of Forgiveness. And we also hear about the Golden Rule, and you even say, no, it's not really a rule. It's a law.
it's a good expression of the way things are. That by the Golden Rule, I mean that, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's really, in my experience, fact of the universe that we do unto others as we do unto ourselves, and we do unto ourselves as we do unto others. And as we go under our layers and layers of conditioning, we find out that deep inside is someone who is essentially kind, and if I can get that kindness directed toward myself, it will automatically begin being directed toward others, because if I'm being kind, then I'm being kind. If I'm not being kind, I'm not being kind, either inner or outer. So the whole dichotomy between, is it harder to forgive yourself or harder to forgive somebody else? It's just two sides of the same coin. We do treat others the way we treat ourselves.
You know, in your book, you use stories and parables, which have been used for centuries to teach. And you invite your readers, at the end of your book, you invite readers of your book to send you their stories.
I'd love to have them send me.
And I'm sure the listeners today, you would like to invite them. So let me give you a website. It's www.thestillpoint.com. Thestillpoint.com. And listeners who might have a story to share with you.
Yes. Through the website, you can find click an email link and just contact me. Or it's just bill@thestillpoint.com. And I would love to hear stories of people's struggles or triumphs with forgiveness. I discovered in writing the book that forgiveness is an essential, absolute quality of life. It's built into the very nature of existence. Without an essential forgiveness in the nature of the Tao, life couldn't exist. The Tao is by its very nature accepting of all, integrates everything into its growth of the universe, and it does this because it is accepting, because it is forgiving, and so are we.
Well, you
deep inside.
you tell a story about this woman who wants to earn points, and she's going to earn 10,000 points.
Yeah. Yeah. This story set at a monastery where the woman accidentally breaks a lamp that the teacher's was her teacher's favorite. And she was just devastated. And to make the long story shorter, the teacher said, well, you know, I'll forgive you if you'll work it off and earn 10,000 points, and you'll earn these points by doing your work. And so she did her work that day, and she reported to the master that night of how she was diligent in the kitchen and diligent in the garden, et cetera, et cetera. And the master smiled and said, that's very, very good. That's one point. And she fell into despair and, you know, one kind of every week or so she'd gain another point. But she kept paying attention to her work. And finally, one day the master asked her, well, how'd you do today? How many points today? I don't know. I just forgot all about it and I just did my work and enjoyed it. And the teacher smiled and said, that's 10,000 points.
So she learned that if you do the work and enjoy it, that's where the value is.
And that forgiveness is not something you earn. That, of course, the minute the lamp broke, the teacher forgave her. But in order to help her understand forgiveness for herself, she had to put her through a process of understanding that she couldn't possibly do enough to earn that, that it was just in the very nature of life. And all she had to do was work in the garden and cook food and enjoy her life.
Bill's book is The Tao of Forgiveness, and it's including in his book are stories, but also exercises. This is practical things. You can sit down, reflect on the story, the parable that they, mm-hmm. the readers just thought about, reflect on the questions that you present. And also you have meditations and kind of poetry form. So you've kind of stuck with the Tao's style.
Yeah, I hope so. Because it's, again, because the whole idea of forgiveness is nonlinear. And I've done some linear writing to try to explain myself, but I also wanted to try to capture the poetic, mysterious quality of it through the exercises and poems and so on.
William Martin's book is The Tao of Forgiveness. After a break, I'll be back with author and playwright Lynn Elliott. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today was born and raised in Cardiff, Wales. In 1965, just after receiving his undergraduate degree from Nottingham, England, Lynn Elliott immigrated to the United States. He completed an MA and PhD from the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's a professor of English and creative writing now at California State University, Chico, and was named Outstanding Teacher. Professor Elliott has written 11 plays, 4 of them won national awards. Today I'm going to be asking him to read from his book, The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales, and I might even get him to sing a Christmas carol from his book. Lynn Elliott, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that you were named Outstanding Teacher because I think you enjoy being a student.
Very much, always a student, as are most good professors, I would say, always students.
Well, one thing that might surprise people as an English professor, you're a student of martial arts.
Exactly. I decided to do this and to do some martial arts a couple of years back. I've always wanted to do something along those lines, and I joined Master of Arts here in Chico and have loved it, loved doing it.
And now you're getting ready to get a black belt.
I know. Stupid, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
In fact, when I first met you 20 years ago, it was over 20 years ago, actually, You were a student. You took my vegetarian cooking class.
Exactly.
Are you still cooking vegetarianly?
A little too busy to do that now. Yeah.
Well, you have a book that you've entitled The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales. And just to refresh people's memory who might not remember, what, a Christmas story in Wales? Who wrote that?
Well, Dylan Thomas wrote A Child's Christmas in Wales, and the way that I open this book is to say, you know, is to actually quote Dylan Thomas, you know, in his opening lines, and immediately somebody says to me, you know, as the narrator says, wait a minute, you can't do that. Dylan Thomas has already done A Child's Christmas in Wales. So then I have hordes of Welsh children going back over to England to live because they can't live their Christmases in Wales anymore. But, and then I say, well, wait a minute. I was a child in Wales. I had Christmas too.
You can claim legitimately.
Exactly. So back they come over Offa's Dyke, which is the delineation between England and Wales. And, you know, and so we celebrate Christmas. And so I'm another child, and I'm sure there are many, many others who have had wonderful Christmases in Wales.
Well, it's especially interesting to those of us who have grown up here because it brings back our memories of Christmases when we were a child, and there are many similarities.
Yes.
But the differences are also very interesting to us, I think. Don't you find that true?
Yeah, you know, whenever I read from this story, I always have people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I had an aunt like that. She covered everything in plastic, including the floor. And one woman told me, she said, you know, my aunt even had a piano that she covered in plastic and had a little zip where you opened it so you could play it. So I didn't, my aunt didn't go that far, but she covered everything in plastic. And, you know, it's the same for most of the stories in this book. People will say, oh, I remember that. I had an uncle like that, an aunt like that.
Well, not only from the stories, but when I just look at the cover of your book, you've got a photograph. Well, one, there's a photograph of you as a child.
I know.
So I'm glad you included that. But there's a photograph below that on the cover of your family. And by George, if my grandmother isn't sitting in your picture. No, obviously it's not my grandmother, but she certainly looks like her.
Right. Yeah, that's Grandma Elliot. And I make quite a number of references to her in the book because, you know, I keep saying, please don't leave, Grandma Elliot. There won't be Christmas without you, because this was the last Christmas we had with her. And indeed, the family just didn't celebrate Christmas as they had in the past when she'd gone.
Well, at the time you're telling the story, we don't know that it is her last Christmas, but we suspect it is because of the way you write the story.
Right.
And this photograph, apparently that's her husband next to her, because at the time of the story, she was a widow.
Yes. So this is a much older photograph. In fact, I can see my father there, and he looks, I would say, about 13. This little man here. So it's an older.
And then, of course, on the back of your book, you have a picture of yourself. We can recognize you. We know what you look like today. And apparently the young person in the picture with you is your sister.
My sister, Yvonne, and both of those pictures there. And then the other one is my mother and father getting married.
I thought that must be
middle,
who that
with
was.
With the uncles behind them.
Because you had a lot of uncles.
Many, many. And then on the inside, there is another picture, and that's my sister Yvonne in traditional Welsh costume.
Oh, well, because you didn't explain that, and I wondered.
No. Mm-hmm. No, these were just photographs that I sent, and they picked these up. But I particularly like this one. He looks a cheeky little devil, doesn't he?
Lynn happens to be pointing to the photograph of himself on the cover. That's an adorable picture, but you look a little younger than 11 there.
Yes. I know my sister has pointed out to me a couple of times about, Lynn, you pulled together a bit from here and a bit from there. And that is true. I'm allowed to do that, a little license on my part.
My guest is Lynn Elliott, and his book is The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales. And the story takes place the Christmas when Lynn was 11 years old. Now, how much of this, because as an artist, a writer, and you obviously can't remember every word that was spoken in these scenes, so you have to reconstruct it. So how much would you say is actually what happened, like this aunt that covered things with plastic? I'm sure that was true.
Yeah.
But how much of it did you have to embellish, if any?
Well, you know, it's very fortunate because I made the decision. I was telling these stories and I made the decision that I was going to write all these stories down. Well, my father was still alive at the time. And so I contacted him back in Cardiff and I said, Dad, I've been thinking about this. And he'd say, oh, remember your Auntie Bess? She used to dance the dying swan, but she would never die. Oh, yeah. So I started writing. And how about your cousin Sylvia? Remember she sang to her father, oh, my beloved father, but he would sound asleep and he'd keep snoring, you know. And so he kept telling me these stories. And yes, they were there. And, you know, the incident with Rose and Noel, others like that, yes, that actually happened, as did the one that I'll be telling today about the man who we had to go and get money from him. It was very scary.
Well, I'm glad you explained that because I thought, now this would be amazing recall for an 11-year-old. But you had a little help stimulating your memory.
Yeah.
And then you could put the scenes all together yourself.
My father, my sister, various cousins, yeah, they helped, you know, to just jog my memory, and I was able to put it all together.
Well, since we've been talking about what your Christmas was like and a Christmas caroling, I don't know if children still go Christmas caroling
yeah,
now,
yeah.
But I did when I was growing up.
Right.
So what happened when you and your friends went caroling Christmas time?
Well, the idea behind caroling was to get money to buy Christmas gifts.
Well, see, so, we didn't know that. We should we weren't as smart as you guys were.
So that's why you see me, my friends and I, as we get around house to house, we go as fast as we can.
Well, why don't you read us
okay.
this part of your book where you and your friends are going Christmas caroling.
Okay. Bring on the carol singers. Some, like the local church groups, would, even after payment, sing a carol or two before moving off. But my friends, Dougie, Pam, and I would, upon payment, instantly disappear, determined to sing as fast as we could, before as many houses as we could, before we return home to count our well-gotten gains. We could get through the first verse of Good King Wenceslas in 10 seconds flat. We started outside Nin Jenkins' house, a guaranteed pound, $2. Then Mr. and Mrs. Griffiths and Mr. and Mrs. Thomas and others. Every so often I stopped between houses and feverishly calculated. If we can do one house in 3 minutes, we can get through 20 in an hour. And if at each house we get an average of about 5 shillings or 50 cents, that comes to about £8 in an hour. And since it's another 2.5 hours before my mother will come looking for me. So much for the best made plans of mice and Welsh children. In our haste, we'd already bolted up the pathway, sung our mandatory four lines, before Dougie lurched backwards and looked around, taking his bearings. Oh, no! 434 Forest Road, Mr. Morris's house. You were supposed to remind us to avoid this one like the plague, Pam. Pam's protests were cut short as a form as solid and as huge as Africa pounded down the hallway, making ornaments and little children jiggle as the earth vibrated. Mr. Morris, pot belly fighting to escape from beneath his grimy vest and drooping trousers, flung open the door, filling it completely, allowing no light inside out, nor no cold outside in. He glowered down at us. I suppose you all think you're getting away with four lines for this halfpenny nickel, don't you? No chance. The wife and I want at least three carols for this nickel, understand?
Three carols,
came the slither of an echo from someone somewhere. If it was the wife back there, we never saw her. Just an unseen voice floating spookily from behind this sweat-smelling behemoth. And none of your rushing.
Rushing?
Or you're singing only one verse.
One verse.
All four of us leaned this way and that, trying to glimpse the diminutive apparition obscured by this human Moby Dick. Start singing loud and clear.
Loud and clear.
For 2 seconds, we children stared at one another, our eyes daring the other to bolt down the path and hide in the lanes. We're waiting.
Waiting.
But the thought of this monster catching us and squeezing us into little tiny clay models of horses or chickens rooted us to the spot. The monster and his phantom spouse got their three ill-gotten carols, and we our well-gotten nickel. It was now time to strike out into unknown territory. And I remember one house with only the flicker of light in the window. The curtain drew back and the face of an old lady stared out at us.
The door's open. Come in,
she cackled. Whoa, I'm not going in, said Dougie. She may be a witch. She could change us into cockroaches.
Not cockroaches, said Pam. Toads.
And a handsome prince would kiss you smack on the lips to break the spell, like this. We're about to race to the next house when the cracked voice spoke again.
My son will give you £1, $2.
Well, that makes a difference, don't it? Responded Dougie. Witches don't give away a pound.
How do you know that?
I read it in a book, a big book, a very big book, this big. That was good enough for Pam and I. Convinced we would not be changed into cockroaches or toads, we crept through the door and into the darkened hallway.
He's down the hallway,
came the voice from the front room.
Unconsciously, we held each other's hands, drawing tighter and tighter together, a carol-singing blob slithering slowly forward.
Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the Feast of Stephen.
A single bulb dangling from the ceiling in the back room was our only light. We were drawn toward it like three unwilling carol-singing moths.
Maybe he's like that woman in the movie, whispered Dougie, the one sitting in a wedding dress, all covered in cobwebs because that man never married her.
We peered into the dull light, the dancing shadows creating images of a cobweb man drooped over his whiskey bottle. There was a man, and there was a bottle, but neither was covered in cobwebs.
The old lady in the front room said you'd give us £2, $5, if we sang a song, a Christmas carol, mister.
Pam punched me in the arm. My lie had sealed our fate.
Ribbit, ribbit, which way to the handsome toad kissing prince?
The bottle arched up to the man's mouth, then slammed back on the table.
We backed out slowly, a trembling, silent night, holy night,
wavering through the darkness. Then the figure moved, slowly sliding his hand into his pocket. £2, $5, dangled from his fingers. We stopped, our voices growing in strength at the sight of money.
All is calm, all is bright.
Down the hallway in the front room, the cracked voice of the old woman floated frailly, joining us. As we sang the second and third verses, the first one three times, Pam nudged me.
You have to get the money, Lynn. Why me? You look most like a toad, giggled Dougie.
I edged forward, sliding up to the man and scrunching up my eyes, prepared for the worst. My thumb and index finger pinched around the £2. For a split second, the whiskey-drinking man and I were joined by the £2, his alcohol-swimming eyes searching mine for his own life lost.
Come with us, mister. Leave your darkened cobweb room, your darkened cobweb whiskey bottle, and your darkened cobweb life. Come with us out into the crisp, carol-singing night air. We'll run from house to house, singing as loud as we can to the nodding moon.
The man released the $2, £2, and his arm dropped onto the table, curling protectively around his whiskey bottle. One last look before I scuttled back triumphantly, treasure in my hand, to my cowering comrades. We raised our voices, silent night, holy night, as we edged backward down the hallway, past the cackling, unseen old lady in the front room, out the front door, down the path and into the street. Now safe, the $2 was, now safe, the £2 was passed from hand to hand.
Let's go round the corner and buy a big box of Cadbury's chocolates for ourselves, said Dougie.
And so we dashed to the shop, bought the biggest box of Cadbury's chocolates we could, and emptied the whole box before you can sing four lines of Good King Wenceslas. That night, none of us ate our dinner. We were scolded by our parents and reminded about saving carol-singing money for Christmas presents. What do you have to say for yourself, Lynn? Asked my mother.
I could have fixed my eyes upon her and, from the depths of my chocolate-churning stomach, bellowed, Oh, ma'am, tonight Dougie, Pam and I stood before a lonely wreck, whiskey-drenched man sitting at a cobweb table, light bulb dangling above his head, his broken sad old mother brooding all by herself in the front room, and we sang for them, and for a small, small moment they seemed to feel better, and I think I understand for the first time what Christmas is really all about, and I'm sorry I spent all the carol singing money on the chocolate for myself, but I felt so happy I just wanted to celebrate and feel complete and good about the world for 1 minute.
But I didn't say those words. Instead, I hung my head and promised that I'd never, Scout's honor, spend carol singing money on myself again.
You've been listening to Lynn Elliott read from his book, The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales. The point, of course, of the singing, in your instance, I mean, we just sang for maybe a cup of hot chocolate, but you were getting paid for it. So the less time you spent at each house, the more money you could acquire.
Exactly.
But when I was reading your book and I read that you were able to sing Good King Wenceslas in 10 seconds flat, I don't know how many times I tried it, and I got it pretty close, but I never got it to 10 seconds.
I have read this story so many times, and every time I read it, there are always people who look at their watch. Immediately I say that, and it's almost like a challenge. You know, can he do it?
But Mine, I tried to say the words. Yours was, I think, unrecognizable.
Exactly, exactly. The object was to get through it quickly, get the money, and my hand went out immediately. We finished a few, well, and then I wanted the money, and I was gone to the next house.
Do you want to try again? And just so people recognize that you're singing Good King Wenceslas, just to sing and see how long it actually takes you. You want to go?
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You mean the 10-second version?
Yeah, right now. Let's see.
Good King Wenceslas, on the feast of the moon, when the sun illuminated, by the bank of even brilliant on the moon, the first one's when the bombman came inside, did they do it?
That was definitely under 10 seconds.
Oh, good. My little self, Lynn Bach, as they say in Wales,
yes,
would have been very proud of me.
In fact, I like the fact that you include some Welsh in there, and you might explain to people why your family referred to you as Lynn Bach.
Bach is like Ito in Spanish. It's a reference to little one. So I was little Lynn Bach. And I should say that one very funny story associated with this was when I was putting it together, I was asked by the president of the university to come and give a reading. Now, there were distinguished guests, trustees and all of the bigwigs, you know, and I said, look, I'm writing this comic thing and I don't think it's appropriate. Anyway, they forced me to do it. So I went there and I was telling the story about my Auntie Bess, who would try to dance the dying swan, but she was so full of Christmas spirit, she could not die until people started yelling at her to die. And the audience were loving it, lapping it up. Anyway, in the audience was Bill Johnson, who's in the theater department. Bill came to me and said, Lynn, we're going to make a drama of that. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. I mean, I'm a playwright, but I didn't know how to incorporate the narrative voice into it. And so he told me about chamber theater. And then he and I worked together and we put on another Charles Christmas in Wales here in Chico. Well, lo and behold, it was picked up by a society in Wales, a drama society in Wales, and it was published and represented by them. So there is another version of this as well, a dramatic version, in addition to the prose version I'm
reading. That you were just reading.
Yeah. Right.
After a break, more of Another Child's Christmas in Wales by Lynn Elliott. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with a Christmas story by author and playwright Lynn Elliott. You have, I mentioned you've written a lot of plays.
Right.
And so you bring that playwriting skill to your story. So I can tell how much you enjoy reading that.
Yeah.
So have you done much acting yourself, or do you just write the words for actors?
I did a lot of acting. And when you're writing, actually a lot of acting goes on because you become the character, you become the voice, and you change. You can hear the voices and you create the voices in your head as you're writing. So I was writing the old woman, you know, and I was writing various uncles and aunts, what they would say. So you sort of act as you're writing.
In fact, that's why I'm such a slow reader, because when I read, I hear these voices and I'm hearing them in my head.
Right.
And they're at normal speaking speed, not like some people that can read fast.
Right.
But you know what? I was surprised too that you didn't gloss over the fact that you were an annoying child sometimes.
Very annoying.
I will say that because maybe to adults, but you're a cat, for example.
Ah, yes.
You annoyed your cat, and we animal lovers think, well, that little rascal.
Well, it was the cat's fault.
Oh,
I mean,
that's
why cats are put upon this earth to annoy little boys and vice versa, I think.
So this poor cat, you would squeak the toy, right?
Yeah. But then, you know, I built a Meccano set. Now, some people don't know what a Meccano is, and it's essentially like a little steel, a construction set, but it has little steel pieces and tiny little nuts and bolts. Well, of course, they're so easy to lose, and this cat would constantly knock it over, and it was a great delight to the cat to destroy my... So there, I'm justifying why I attacked the cat with the squeaky toy.
Yeah, so it wasn't that you were mean. You were just annoying, returning the annoyance.
Exactly. The cat deserved it, no doubt about it.
Well, something else I wondered about when I was reading this, it doesn't sound very appealing, but you mentioned that all of the carolers and you love sweets, and there was boiled sweet, and that just doesn't sound very appealing.
It's just...
I mean, Cadbury's chocolate, yes.
Right. Now, boiled sweets are just hard candy. Very hard candy. So I can't think of an example, you know, but it's just a hard candy. That's what they call them over there, boiled sweets. Yeah.
Well, I mentioned that you had a large family.
Right.
And you talk about, well, after the caroling scene that you read for us, you tell us what it was like to try to spend Christmas Day with all these different sets of family members. Mm-hmm. And so you start with in the morning. And at what point did you go to this aunt who covered everything with plastic?
Well, that was my aunt, and that was Christmas morning. We'd have to, you know, after looking through all the various presents and going through all the candies and everything else, then we would go up to visit this aunt. Now, for some unknown reason, my uncle and my aunt were the black sheep of the family, and they did not participate in...
Unknown to you, probably.
Unknown to me.
I
don't know why.
The rest of the family as adults may have known the history, but you weren't privy to that information.
But my mother and father, as I say in the book, you know, they were wonderful souls, and they would go take us up there to... my father used to make elderberry wine. And you probably saw the story about the cat who fell in the elderberry wine right
yes.
there. And, exactly. But he would make elderberry wine. We'd go up to visit my my uncle, Thomas it was. Actually, I changed his name in the book. And Auntie Phyllis. And she would cover everything in plastic. And as I say, dust and little children were her mortal enemies. And so we had to be very careful. And that's when I was trying to determine how do you hold a cup and a plate with a cookie on it, and somehow get these to your mouth without spilling. When you had the hawk eyes of my aunt watching me all the time, and it was, I mean, I told that story many times. I tell them not only at the university but around town and to senior citizens groups and things like that. I've told them in San Francisco, etc. And people always come up to me after and say, I had an aunt like that. I had an aunt. Yeah, they always do that. Or memories that I have that they have in some form.
Some variation
of
that.
Exactly.
My guest is Lynn Elliott, and his book is The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales. And in this book, in this story, you pick the year when you're 11 years old. And when your family then, besides this aunt who's no fun at all,
right.
But then you go to other family members where there is a lot of fun. People mm-hmm. are having fun and they're singing, and you even tried some magic tricks.
Oh, yes. What happened was Christmas Day night, we would all gather together at Grandma Elliot's house, and we would have to perform. Now, the children were very religious about this. I mean, I would probably begin in July practicing and preparing for the Christmas
pageant.
You know, exactly. And but that was not the case with my aunts and uncles. They would try to remember things from last year. And one I recently told at the university was of my uncle, Jim, for example. He would sing, speak to me, Flora, speak to me once again. Could never remember any more words. And after a couple of times, somebody would say, boy, I wish Flora would speak to him, otherwise we'll have to listen to this song every year. And it was just like that all the time. There were the great, the not so great. And there's one funny incident that I had to cut out of a recent talk I gave for time's sake. But we had this couple called Howell and Pat Evans, and they were on the BBC. They were comedians. They were very talented. But they would tell jokes. Now, these jokes got worse as the night went on. And I tell this joke and I start the
worse
joke.
Worse or a little bluer?
Bluer. Oh, I mean, we're talking about mauve and dark blue by this time. But this joke that I remember the beginning of, and I could tell it, but it's like an old monk in a monastery thinks to himself, never had to confront temptation. So down he goes to the bar. There sits Goronwy Evans with his daughter Blodwyn, who had the biggest... My world suddenly went silent as my mother jammed both of her fingers into my ears so they touched in the middle of my brain. And it was exactly that, you know, they were jamming them in my, and I would be looking around and this huge feast was going on, but I wasn't a participant, nor was my sister who'd been sent out of the room, you know. And we would just look at these people roaring with laughter and we'd have no idea why they were
roaring.
What
the joke was.
Exactly. I still don't know to this day what happened to that joke.
Well, a lot of your family, I mentioned that you tried your hand at magic tricks, not too
right.
well.
No.
But a lot of your family sang, and your father in particular.
Yes. Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me then that you are a singer yourself.
Exactly.
And you sing here in Chico. People
exactly,
probably heard your
yes.
lovely tenor voice.
Right.
Where might they have heard it?
I sing in the university choir. I sing in the local church. I also sing with a group called the Celtic Knights of the Sea. So Wales is known as the land of song. And so people love to sing. And if you want to see something very unusual at a rugby game in Cardiff Arms Park or Cardiff Millennium Stadium now, you can actually hear 60,000 people singing. And they're not only singing beautifully in harmony, but they start to harmonize. You know, you get the tenors and the basses, and I'm sure you can find those
on YouTube. So a group
of
people who don't even know each other.
Exactly.
They come
yeah.
together and
yeah.
they can sing.
They sing. They come from up in the valleys, as we call it, you know, the Rhondda Valley and places like that to sing. And I think, you know, what was so interesting about the life-loving quality of the people that I grew up with was most of them were miners, you know, and they'd come down from Tonopandy to live in Cardiff. They were miners. And so as miners, they live so close to death. Because once the siren sounded, there was something gone wrong in the pit, and everybody would rush down to find out, you know, who was alive, who was not alive. So they lived that close that the result was they had this tremendous love for life, and that's why I captured it, I hope, in this book, this boundless energy that they had, you know, overwhelming sometimes as I
So it wasn't just your family that was lively, but that's,
I mean, they're a very lively bunch, you know, and they love singing. It's a passion for the Welsh, certainly.
My guest has been the story of Another Child's Christmas, his book, The Story of Another Child's Christmas in Wales by Lynn Elliott. Mm. Lynn, do you remember enough Welsh to say Merry Christmas?
I'm going to wish you Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
In Welsh?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Nadolig llawen a blwyddyn newydd dda I chi. To you.
Thank you, Lynn. I'd also like to thank my first guest, William Martin, author of The Tao of Forgiveness.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.